Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and a beautiful day in that there was a sunrise, but about a minute after it rose, it clouded over. And in a ski town, that's good because it means the forecast tonight is for 100% chance of snow. The Weather Service is not...
100% chance. You don't see that
how
often.
How often does the Weather Service call something at 100%? They like to leave a little room for error, but they say 100% chance of snow tonight. And, Doug, welcome back. Appreciate having you back after
a
Thanksgiving sojourn last week. And we have an interesting show this morning on three totally different subjects, two of which near and dear to every Parkite's heart. First, we're going to talk about the healthcare forum we have tonight. We'll be talking with Intermountain Healthcare's federal government relations executive, Bill Barnes. Bill will be on the line shortly, and we'll be talking to him about all things related to the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And he will be part of our panel tonight as we convene at the Santee Auditorium for a social at 5 and then a forum about the Health Care Act at 6. So we'll be talking to Bill in just a moment.
And our second guest is going to be Bryn Carey. He's the president of Ski Butlers. We've all seen the Ski Butler vans riding around town. Actually, they have 35 locations in the U.S. and includes Canada. So they've grown quite a bit since they started in 2004. And we're going to talk to Bryn and hear more about what's going on at Ski Butlers. And then our last guest is going to be Kate Bjordahl. She's a veterinarian, and she's the owner of Powder Paws Clinic, which is out by Jeremy Ranch. And we're going to talk to her about her business and her service helping keep the cats and dogs. Park City is also known as Bark City, and we got to keep those barkers
so
healthy.
So we're talking about skiing. We're talking about dogs and cats and other pets, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. And we'll start with the Affordable Care Act and Bill Barnes after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Tune in to KPCW every Tuesday morning at 9 to hear This Green Earth.
We'll cover environmental issues from local to global, from snowpack to giant squid,
geothermal energy to gray wolves,
and honeybees to sustainable chocolate. Brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and we have Bill Barnes on the line with us now. And Bill manages federal government relations for Intermountain Healthcare, and as such, he's been involved in the Affordable Care Act since it was a baby, long before it was delivered, back when they were writing it up. And it's now being delivered, and we wanted to get Bill's take on how it's rolling out and what's in it and what's not in it that's going to be relevant to all of us. And Bill, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you.
Well, we wanted to start by talking about the rollout, which is, I guess, the end of the process. Not the beginning. We'll go back to the beginning. But first, let's talk about how healthcare.gov rolled out, and of course all the anti reaction to it from Republicans in Congress. But did you expect the rollout to be as shaky as it was, or isn't it that shaky and it just is being made to sound that shaky?
It's pretty shaky, and I think everybody expected there'd be some rough bits. It maybe has been worse than people expected, but you know, we're hearing a lot about the federal exchange and the problems, and there really is no excuse for some of the problems. But at the same time, you've got to realize that, you know, half of Congress has been doing everything they can to make it a problem. The House has not appropriated the money they needed to do the development. We've had about half of the country's governors fighting it. And, you know, originally the intent was that most of the states would run their own exchanges. And so I think the federal government, and this is not an excuse, but the federal government ended up doing a lot bigger job than they'd anticipated. And it's not just one exchange. It's an exchange that covers all these different states with the different insurance requirements. But it has been a problem. Hopefully they're getting it fixed. But what's lost in all the appropriate bad news is that there's a lot of state exchanges that are doing the job that they were intended to do, and people are enrolling in those states where they have state exchanges and where they're working, because there's some problems with some of the state exchanges as well.
Well, in fact, everybody's kind of pointing to California as a shining example of how to do it right.
Right. They seem to be, it seems to be working there. It seems to be, people seem to be enrolling with relative ease. On the other hand, Oregon has maybe the worst reputation of state exchanges. So the state exchanges aren't immune, but certainly the federal exchange is not the whole story.
Bill, I want to go back to Larry's original intro, where he shared, you know, IHC has been involved in this since really the Affordable Care Act was really just, we weren't sure if it was going to pass or what was going to be included. And what were the types of things IHC was involved in letting the legislatures know the types of things that were important to them, as were many other healthcare providers? What were the type of things that were important to IHC that you wanted to see included or not included in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, yeah, first of all, it's important not to overstate the role Intermountain had. I mean, we expressed our opinion to our delegation and to others when we could, and you know, I think a lot of the discussion in those days was concern about, a federal program to compete with insurers. You'll recall that one of the proposals that survived till way into the process was that the government might set up their own insurance company to, quote, keep the insurance companies honest. And, you know, we don't think that that's necessarily the best way to do things. We believe that the market is good and the insurance companies generally work well where there's competition and so forth. So those are the kinds of things. You have to recall, this is primarily an insurance company-related bill, an insurance-related bill, more than it is a care provider bill. But there are some provider issues in it, and they're not exactly done maybe the way we would have chosen. But we just tried to express our opinion as best we could to our delegation and to others who would listen.
Big healthcare providers like IHC, like Kaiser Permanente, like any number of others that dominate their particular states, are they generally pleased with the way the law was written in the end? Is this a law that allows you to concentrate on providing healthcare as best you can?
I will say that we have been very careful not to try and take a position on the law, pro or con. There are some very good things in the law, some very bad things in the law. But if you look at what it does for providers, one thing it does begin that I think Intermountain and all the other like-minded providers in the country are very pleased with the goals and the aspirations of the law to change the way care is delivered in those narrow sections of the law that deal with that. For example, there's one section that sets up what the federal government calls accountable care organizations. We are totally supportive of those goals. And the goal is to change the way healthcare is delivered to a cooperative team-based approach and change reimbursement from the current historic fee-for-service reimbursement that just incents providers to do more things, to maybe have them change their focus towards preserving and improving population health, so that we're encouraging health, not encouraging treatment of illness, as it were. So we're totally supportive of the goals. We do have concerns. Interestingly enough, I think that section of the law was actually written to encourage companies to act more like Intermountain aspires to act. But as the federal government often does, they made the process and structure so cumbersome that Intermountain actually chose not to participate in that offering by the federal government. And we're doing something that's not dissimilar, but without all the kind of structural requirements that the federal government would have imposed upon us had we gone with their program. So there's a lot of places where we totally agree with the goals, but, you know, the process as created in the law is something that we may or may not be so enthusiastic about.
So, Bill, I want to remind our listeners that 3 or 4 years ago, IHC was highlighted, actually, in the State of the Union address by President Obama. You guys probably knew it was coming, but when I was watching the speech live, I was surprised and I was quite impressed. So first off, congratulations on that.
Well, should I be really honest?
Please,
we did not know that was coming.
Really?
But I did take the opportunity to tell my boss the next day that I don't think Intermountain had ever been singled out by the President of the United States prior to my assuming the responsibility for federal government relations.
And there was that email you sent to the whitehouse.gov.
Yeah, so, you know, in fairness, we did not. I think we were not aware that he was going to cite us in the speech. We were very pleased that he did.
Very cool. So, and so my question is, obviously, IHC in your role in making sure that Washington knows what IHC's concerns are and what they'd like to see and what they think is best going forward. You guys have been very successful at that. And I think a lot of folks feel powerless, you know, when they see things happening that they think should be done differently. And what advice would you give to maybe a small business owner that says, hey, I want to have my voice heard on this. I've got an opinion on this, and I want Washington to know about this. What are a couple steps that a small business owner, a head of a household, a head of a family can do to have some influence, some impact on Washington, D.C.?
Well, you know, in fairness, the most impactful thing they can probably do is contact their own representative and senator. And depending on the issue, if you're in health care, you know, Utah is kind of fortunate in a way because we do have a couple of people on key committees. Jim Matheson is on the Health Subcommittee of Energy and Commerce, which is the Committee of Jurisdiction, is the term they use for most health care issues in the House of Representatives. So he is, you know, well-positioned to express an opinion and to so forth. But, you know, he is just one member of 435 members of the House. There's only so much he can do, but he's in a better position to do it than most. On the Senate side, Senator Hatch is the ranking member, which means the senior member of the minority party on the Senate Finance Committee, which is one of the two committees in the Senate that has oversight of health care issues. Anything that has to do with health care and money goes through the committee that Senator Hatch is on. He's also a member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. He is a senior member, but he's not the ranking member. So, again, we're well represented in the Senate by Senator Hatch on health care issues. And other members of Congress, I mean, if the issue is not health care, obviously, you've got Senator Lee's on Armed Services, you've got Chris Stewart on Armed Services, and you know, whatever the issue is, find the people that have you know, the connections. But even if your member of Congress isn't on the appropriate committee, they are in a position to have their voice heard by those who are on those committees. So to the extent you can build a relationship with them and communicate positively with them, that's the opportunity you have. You're always welcome to write the White House and administrative agencies. You probably would have one voice would probably have less influence with them than you would with your own member of Congress.
Although, on the other hand, Bill, the reality is in Utah, universally all four members of the House, including the Democrat, and both senators voted against the ACA. So Utah does not really have a strong voice in do they in making changes, amendments, suggesting other approaches? They all just want to kill it.
Well, that gets to the heart of kind of the frustrations of many of us. I mean, the law is the law today. It has survived. The day after it passed the House, literally, the Republicans in the House filed the first bill to repeal it.
And they voted how many times? It's like 40 or some
well,
times.
The last number I heard was 43 times that they'd voted to repeal it.
But, we get the message, House.
Yeah, but until or unless, you know, the Democrats lose their majority in the Senate and lose the presidency, this is and will be the law. And it's you know, billions of dollars have been spent implementing it. It would cost billions of dollars to repeal it and dismantle it. Right now, I see nothing on the horizon that tells me that this is going to be repealed. And so the question becomes, I was actually in the 6 months or so after the law passed, I was out speaking at lunches, you know, Rotary clubs and, you know, Kiwanis clubs and all these kind of groups. And in one of those meetings, one man asked an interesting question that really stood out to me. He said, okay, do you think in 10 years Congress will look back and say we did a good thing with this? That was the first time and only time I've been asked that question. And I can't speak for Congress, but I kind of said, you know, I don't really have an answer to that, but I do have an answer that I believe is accurate. In 10 years, they'll look at the law as it then stands, and it will be a very different law than it is today. Medicare, whatever the big laws have passed, none of them have gone as originally drafted, you know, for very long. They've all had significant amendments and changes. And I guess my argument to our delegation is and has been, you know, it's time for the two sides to start working together to improve the areas that need improving.
And that's a nice takeaway, Bill. What you're saying is although it's the dream of Republicans to and conservatives and Tea Party of any stripe to repeal this law and fast, it's not going to happen.
Well, not that I see in the near future. Certainly not, you know, for several years, because we still have President Obama for, you know, three more years. So it's going to be at least that long before it's even a remote possibility. So, unfortunately, the antagonism, but, and I'm not saying Tea Party, Republican, this is on both sides. Neither party is really willing or able to sit down with the others in a constructive way and work, and that's maybe the tragedy of it.
So let's stay on that topic for a second, if we can. We had, a month ago, 2 months ago now, the shutdown of the U.S. government, the impasse. We've got it facing us again in the coming weeks. It seems to me that things have gotten worse, not better. The ability to compromise has totally dissolved, and it doesn't. Maybe it's just rose-colored glasses from when I was younger, but it seemed like there was more compromise 20 years ago than there is today. Why do you think Congress in Washington's at such an impasse?
Well, there's two reasons. One of them is I blame it on airplanes.
Okay.
And that is, you know, you go back 30, 40 years. This is a conversation I actually have had with Senator Bennett. He talks about when he was a kid and his father was the senator from Utah, you know, the family would get on the train in the early fall and they'd head back to Washington. And, you know, his dad would come back and forth for business, you know, sometimes relatively frequently by the measure of the time. But really, they spent a lot of time in Washington. They socialized. They communicated. You know, on weekends, the senators had barbecues with each other. They, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they got, it's hard to be as disagreeable with a friend as it is with somebody you don't know. It's just difficult. And, you know, now, when I'm flying back to Washington, if I'm flying back on Monday morning, frequently the whole Utah delegation is on the plane. If I'm coming home on Thursday night, frequently the whole Utah delegation is on the plane. You know, they're there, they do their business, they're swamped with emails. They used to have to, somebody wanted to communicate with them before, they used to have to actually, like, write a letter, you know. And so the pace of Congress has sped up dramatically, and with the way they commute on weekends back and forth, they're never in a position to get to know each other. So I think that's part of the issue. And I guess the other part is just that people get what they vote for. And the populace, I mean, you know, we have these two very loud extremes on both ends of the spectrum. And then the majority of the people in the middle just don't have the passion that those extremes have. They don't make the noise the extremes have, and as a consequence, they don't exercise the influence that the extremes have. So if you have the extremes in the voting public exercising the power, you tend to get extremes in your representation.
You know,
that's true on both sides.
Okay. You know, there were lots of extreme things said during the debate over passing the Affordable Care Act, you know, death panels and things like that, that some government panel would decide who lives and dies at the end of life.
Do you know the origin of that
and,
one?
And really? are you still fielding lots of crazy rumors?
Yes. I mean, the death panels one, that actually was a provision. Right now, if you wanted to have a conversation with your doctor about end-of-life care, just a conversation, the doctor doesn't get paid for that. And there was a provision in the original law that would allow a Medicare code for somebody, for a doctor, that would allow them to have up to one conversation a year with a patient about end-of-life care and get paid for it. That's what became death panels. So, you know, there's a lot of passion on both extremes. I actually got an email from one of our employees just recently outlining all these horrible things that were going to happen that they'd gotten from a friend. So this employee was saying, you know, what can we do to help this person? And basically this email that they'd gotten from a friend was saying, I was able to get online this afternoon, take a look at what my options are because I still have two kids at home and blah, blah, blah. Here's what I find out. My monthly cost for affordable health insurance would be $689 with a $14,000 yearly deductible. And he goes on saying that he received an email back from the website saying that the fine would be $7,028 and could be attached to my yearly income tax return if he didn't get insurance, right? Well, actually, the fine is $95 or 1% of your income. So if his fine was $7,000, that means he's making over $700,000.
And can afford it.
And I hope that money he could afford it. And then he goes on, he's saying your driver's license will be suspended if you don't pay it. That's just absolutely false. If you go 24 consecutive months with non-payment and you're a homeowner, you'll have a federal tax lien placed on your home. That's just false. You know, there's just a lot of scare tactics around. Now, and I'm not endorsing the law or opposing it, but If you're going to be getting some of these scary things, this neither is going to bring about world peace and solve world hunger, nor is it going to, you know, rip unborn babies from their mother's wombs and have people's houses taken away. The truth is somewhere in the middle, and it pays people to ask good questions. You know, call your insurance company. That's maybe the best source to get good information, because insurance companies are in this up to their eyebrows. You know, there are good things about it. I mean, the philosophy behind it is great. Let's get everybody into the insurance pool. Let's spread the risk. Let's make it so people who have pre-existing conditions or chronic illnesses can get insurance. I think most of us would agree with all that. But let's get the facts about how that's happening, and if you like it, fine. If you don't, fine. But there are specific provisions in the law. The only thing they can do to collect the penalty for not buying insurance is in your tax returns, and there's specific provisions against any sort of garnishment of wages or seizure of assets or any sort of criminal penalty or criminal process going against you for not doing it. So it's really just a financial incentive to purchase insurance, nothing more, nothing less.
Well, Bill, those are great notes to close on. Our guest this morning is Bill Barnes. He's the Federal Government Relations Officer at IHC. Bill, we thank you for your candor this morning and for joining us on Mound Money.
I look forward to being with you this evening as well.
And this evening, you can ask your questions of Bill Barnes and other panelists at our Affordable Care Forum, Healthcare Forum, and that begins with a social food and beverage at the Santee Auditorium at 5 o'clock. If you're getting off work then, we're trying to make it convenient so you can come by, visit with us, have a snack, and then stay for the forum, which begins at 6:06 when NPR News ends. And we will be broadcasting that if you can't make it down to the Santee. But please come down to the Santee if you can and hear from a panel of experts about the Affordable Care Act. And as we were talking, the first few little snow flurries showed up. They've dissipated now, but more is expected. Today we're expecting a high of 45 under cloudy skies, but tonight, late tonight, we are expecting snow and a low of 20 and a snow chance of 100%. And we will be back to talk about skiing and pet care. We'll first talk with Bryn Carey of Ski Butlers after this.
This is Tom Rowney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was a fascinating conversation with Bill Barnes of IHC. As I said in the closing, I appreciated his candor. He was much more, his answers were much more straightforward than I thought they might be, given his role of dealing with Washington. Our current guest is Bryn Carey. He's the president of Ski Butlers. Bryn, you started off here in Park City in 2004, and now you guys, my notes tell me, you service 35 North American resorts. Congratulations, and tell us a little bit about some of the new things that Ski Butlers is doing this season.
Well, I think the newest thing for Ski Butlers this year is our new website. We launched it about a month ago. It's a responsive design website, so it goes to mobile. You can book on your mobile phone, your tablet, or your computer. And then in addition to that, of course, we're bringing back our new team members and our awesome equipment and legendary service.
And let's talk about the website, because that is what's new. You've always been able to rent skis online, right?
Yeah, so from year one in 2004, you could rent online. But the technology has come a long way in the past 10 years, and especially in the last few years.
Okay, so let's talk about we'll get back to the website, but let's talk about Ski Butlers before we get too deep into one side of it. So what was your vision has just taken off, and you've won every kind of award for entrepreneurship and small business development, and it's one of these businesses that incubated here in basically a garage, I suppose. And what niche did you see unfilled in ski towns?
Well, the idea of Ski Butlers is very, very simple, and it's to make a ski vacation more convenient and hassle-free. And what we saw is where customers or visitors were coming to Park City and other ski areas and had ski lessons in the morning, didn't have their ski rentals, traveled across the country, ski shops were closing early. So we thought if we could deliver ski rentals to our customers, make their vacation more convenient and hassle-free, we would gain loyal customers, and that's what we've done.
And really, at the time, the model was you go to the ski resort, you rent your skis there, or there's a couple shops in town. And you rent your skis from that physical location. Were you one of the first in town to say, we'll bring the skis to you, we'll bring the process to your hotel room?
Yeah, we were the second company in town, but one of the pioneers of taking it to 10 locations and creating the network. And being one of the few ski shops that actually just does ski rental and delivery. We do have a walk-in in Park City, but 95% of our business is ski rental delivery, where other shops now we'll do about 50-50.
And are most of your rentals to beginners? Because, you know, as you get better at skiing, like Larry said, if I ever need to rent skis, as you get better at skiing, you know, you have a set of skis that you want to take. Unfortunately, it's very expensive to take them, but the advanced skiers prefer to take their own skis.
Well, that's a great question. So our main customers are skiers that come here and ski probably 4 to 6 days a year. And they will rent skis, boots, poles, helmet, and whatnot. Now, the new trend that we're seeing because of the airline baggage fees is that people will bring their own boots, but will rent the newest equipment when they come to a place like Park City. Or if you ski the East Coast, your skis might be better suited for the groomers and the more hard pack. And you come out west, you want a wider ski. That'd be better for our conditions out here. So we're seeing everyone start to rent.
And how does it pencil out? I mean, skis now are... have commas, you know, they're $1,200 for a nice pair of skis and bindings, maybe if you're paying full retail. So does it for that occasional skier, does it pencil out at what is a high-end rental, $60, $70 a day?
Yeah, so the top demo equipment's about $60 a day, the basics about $30 to $40 a day. So if someone comes out here for 4 days, $60, a little over $200, where if you're going to spend $800 to $1,200 for a pair of skis every few years with a new technology, it could make sense. If you're going to ski every day.
The hassle, you've got to sell them. If you want to ski the latest and greatest, if you're only skiing 4 or 5 days, you're selling them 3 years later. You got that hassle, and you got to buy the new stuff as well. Speaking of which, what do you guys do with your skis at the end of the season?
So we have an online gear outlet called the Ski Butlers Gear Outlet, and we'll sell all of our demos on there. The gear is in excellent or good shape. If anything's really beat up, we do not even list it on the website. We offer shipping for $25, or if you're local, you can come pick up for free. And you can return the gear. If you don't like it, you can return it within 30 days.
And are you exclusively renting Rossignol?
Yeah, so we have a partnership with the Rossignol Group. And the idea with that is to have the same equipment across all 10 of our Ski Butler locations. So you have that Starbucks feel. If you go to Vail, you like a ski, you come to Park City, you can use that same ski and know you're going to have the same service and the same equipment.
So interesting that you use the Starbucks model, right? And great companies copy from other great companies. And one of the challenges you have is you service 35 resorts. You've got people throughout the country. And how do you make sure that the employee that's driving the van, the seasonal employee that's meeting with the guests, gives them the experience that is something you'll be proud of?
Well, this is the secret success of Ski Butlers, Ed. Fitting today is our orientation for our team members. So they started this morning for our returning team members and new team members. But we use the Net Promoter Score. And so every customer receives a survey, and each team member is tied back to that customer in that survey. And within the company, they are ranked from 1 to 20 in each location of where they stand. And they also get bonus each month. So if they score a certain percentage on the Net Promoter Score, which is the customer service score, they receive up to a few $100 bonus. So that incentivized the team members to really, really not just take care of the customer, but to wow the customer.
This is what always impresses me, right? I mean, this does not happen by accident. It takes good customer service does not happen by accident. It takes a lot of forethought, and you've clearly thought through it. You articulated it very clearly, and I can see where your employees would say, okay, I understand what it takes to succeed at Ski Butlers.
Yeah, and that's the idea with our guys, especially coming in today, that by even after the end of the first day of orientation, they know that if they take care of the customer, they will be successful. They'll have more opportunities, and it'll be a more fulfilling winter.
Now, your model is to take the skis to the customer. So I would think that way cuts down the efficiency of what one technician can do in the course of an hour. I mean, it could take an hour to drive to, I don't know, a condo in Upper Deer Valley, even find it, schlep the gear in, say hi and socialize for a few minutes, and then go back to the store.
Yeah, so normally we do our fittings on the hour, so every customer has an hour. And so normally that ski tech will go to a place in Deer Valley, and then their next delivery will be very close to that. So we kind of keep it efficient that way. And then at the delivery, I think we are some of the first people that the visitors of Park City get to really talk to and ask questions. Right. So we can really spend an hour building a great relationship and offering that awesome customer service.
So I presume you get a lot of repeat business.
That's
what makes it pay.
Exactly.
Is not getting a new customer each time.
Yeah, well, we like to use our customers to refer to their friends and get new customers. I think that's the reason we've seen such growth over the past 10 seasons.
So you mentioned you're one of the first that gets to see the customer. And you're face-to-face. You've got a van there with you. Have you thought about, are there other products or services that you can offer clients when they first come to Park City?
Well, another service that we've started this year is the Ski Butler Store. And it works two ways. One, customers can go on there and have anything they order shipped back to wherever they are. Or we can deliver it on the delivery. So that is our new...
Is that grocery? Can they do groceries that way?
No. Patagonia okay. Jackets, Smartwell.
Oh, ski related. Yeah, they're not going to bring you T-bones.
Yeah, so in terms of delivering other items, no. We want to, again, keep what we do very, very simple.
And I did, and I looked at the store, and it was a pretty limited, very ski-focused, mostly accessory kind of items, goggles and such.
Exactly, and it's not, you know, it's not a Zappos, it's not a Backcountry. It's the store is for our customers, and if we can provide them base layers, socks, gloves, goggles, those type of items, we feel like we can increase the customer service and increase their visit here.
So I meet a lot of people on the lifts, you know, that are from Florida or Southern California, and I know the only reason they've got this, you know, $1,500 ski jacket, ski pants, gloves is for this trip, and they don't use it any other time. Is there, but yet you don't see anybody renting out the soft goods. Is there a reason for that? Have you looked at it? Does it just not pencil out?
You know, across our 10 locations, here and there, there are a few companies that do rent, you know, the ski pants and the jacket. We haven't – usually when people call us, it's because they lost their gear or they lost their luggage flying here. So they usually get the gear the next day. So we haven't decided to dive into that. But we do rent helmets. We do rent goggles. So there are a few small items.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, but let's talk quickly about the website one last time, because that's what's gonzo and new this year. How long did it take you to develop a site as deep and simple at the same time?
Well, I think we first started planning about a year ago, and then we really dived into the development in June, and we launched at the beginning of October. So about a year of making it happen, and about 5 months of really diving deep into it.
And is that hiring out to a design company, the method of doing it, or did you guys figure that out too?
Well, we've worked with a website company for 9 seasons, and we have a design, Joe Myers, who does all of our design. So we have a great team that surrounds us that is, you know, specializes in what they do, and we work with them to make it happen.
Well, you're smart to make it work on your phone, because things move very quickly in technology, and I think most people, when they think about renting their skis and that's something they want to do while they're waiting for their plane at the airport. It's not when they're at their desktop at 9 o'clock at night and the kids have gone to sleep.
Exactly. A lot of our customers call us when they're getting on a plane or sit at the airport and can book on the van up to Park City. So if we can make it easy for them, then we're doing our job.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for joining us. Bryn Carey, president of Ski Butlers, has a new online store and rental location, and that's at what, skibutlers.com?
Yep, you can find us at skibutlers.com or in town down at the next to the Marriott and Prospector.
Very fine. Well, thanks for joining us. And coming up next, Kate Bjordahl, doctor of veterinary medicine from Powder Paws Vet Clinic. Stay tuned for more Mountain Money.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
The Park City Chamber Bureau will host its annual Winter Kickoff Mixer and Activities Expo on Wednesday, December 4th, from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at Park City Mountain Resort's Legacy Lodge. The Winter Kickoff Mixer showcases Chamber Bureau members who provide winter season activities, entertainment, and events, and is a great opportunity to learn about what they offer. There will be free food and beverages and a cash bar. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, please contact the Nonprofit Chamber Bureau at 649-6100.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We just finished a conversation with Bryn Carey, president of Ski Butlers. He's about to get very, very busy, I think. And another person that's about to get very, very busy in Park City is Kate Bjordahl. She's a veterinarian, and in mid-September, she opened up Powder Paws Veterinary Clinic out by Jeremy Ranch. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And was this a lifelong dream to open up your own clinic, or did you have your own clinic somewhere before Park City?
No, it's been a lifelong dream. I've worked as a veterinarian since 2002, and I've just always been interested in the business part of it. I love working as a vet, but I also enjoy the business aspect, and I thought just long-term I'd want to explore that option, and the dream
came
true. Well,
you're definitely going to learn the business aspects now that you're paying the rent and the wages.
Well, it is. It's setting up a small business, and so correct. So you're responsible for everything. And do you have other employees? And
Yes, and I have three employees.
Three employees, and where are you located?
I'm located off Rasmussen Road, right near down from the Jeremy Ranch School, next to Burt Brothers, and in that Summit Center complex.
Do you worry that you'll spend more time on business than pets? And
that's tough, balancing the caseload of seeing, you know, lots of patients a day and managing to get the business duties done, you know, payroll and, you know, pay your bills at the end of the day. But it's so far been, I've been able to make it work.
Now, have you found, you said you've been a vet since 2002. Is the vet business relatively resistant to economic cycles? People have their dogs, the dog or cat needs health care, and people take them in? Or do you find that people cut back when the economy is tough?
No, we found in 2008, 2009, people were cutting back, definitely waiting longer to see veterinarians. And unfortunately, waiting longer sometimes made things cost more because the animals were sicker and we couldn't do as much preventative maintenance. There are certain areas, Park City, that I think people were still, you know, spending, you know, more dollars on their pets because they're more part of the family and they try to do what they can. But in times of economic downturn, you may not have that extra dollar to spend, you know, on your pets and may wait longer if they have something going on.
You know, I can think of three or four or five vet clinics already in the Park City area. I mean, is this a pretty competitive field or is there enough business for everybody? There's plenty of dogs and cats, that's for sure.
It's a competitive field. There are some equations that when I went into this, I definitely looked into the area and its growth and how many pets per household and how many vets it could support, you know, and it what it looked like is that it could support the addition of my practice. One of the factors in this area is the second homeowners bring a lot of pets too, and they're not registered in a lot of the when you look up, you know, demographics in the area, they're not registered as far as pet owning households and all that. But that is another factor. I know from working up here, we see a lot of them and have to fill out a lot of travel health certificates for them shipping out of the country and out of the state with their pets, because we have to sign for them every time a pet crosses state line on a plane or anything of that matter.
So I'm curious. I've got a dog. I've had a dog, you know, most of my life. Our first lab lived to be about 16. She passed on, and, you know, 6 months later, we got another lab. We love labs. But I've never really tracked, and I probably don't want to track, how much we spend a year just taking care of our dog, you know, what the total cost is to the family. It's really not something that we get joy out of it, so we won't want to track. But I'm curious, what does the average family spend? You probably know for health care for their dog or for their cat, and it's probably different for the two.
It actually varies a lot by the breed of dog, believe it or not. Bulldog owners are some of the highest spenders on veterinary care versus other dogs.
Is that because bulldogs are more complicated beasts? Or
yeah, they get a lot more.
Their owners are more complicated.
They get a lot more problems. I mean, there are averages. The Animal Hospital Association did some studies on averages spent per dog, and, you know, and the average household had 50% of households had a dog or cat per household and made one veterinary visit a year. And, you know, the average is somewhere, I can't recall exactly, it was $120 to $171 on preventative care per year.
So it's not much. It's not as much as what I would have guessed.
Yeah, but it depends. Like I said, if you have a problematic, you know, a dog with genetic problems that's born with, you know, bad hips, or bulldogs get a lot of skin infections and ear infections or allergies, you know, those can all factor into vet care.
They look like worried dogs. You know, all that anxiety can't be
good for
their health.
But yeah, they do. They've just been, that's just one of the things that's been cited, that people spend more depending what breed they own too.
So here's where I was going with that question. 2 years ago, I took our dog to the vet, and when I was checking out, Larry, you and I were talking in the green room about pet insurance. And when I was checking out, they said, hey, have you thought your dog's at the age where you can still get pet insurance? And I looked at it and I thought, you know, this, for me, it didn't make sense. But what I told the lady that was telling me about it is, what would make a lot of sense is if the vet himself offered me insurance, just said, hey, you know, $20 a month, $50 a month, whatever it is, you come in, I'll take care of your dog. And if it's something more complicated that I can't do, sorry, it's not going to be covered under this policy. Do people do that, and have you thought about doing it so it's more of a recurring, dependable source of income for you?
Yeah, I looked actually. I did a ton of research on that before starting up, and people are starting to do that. Some of the actually insurance the actual insurance companies for pets, some of the big ones, veterinary pet insurance, VPI, are offering to administer those plans in-house to some veterinary clinics for veterinarians. The problem is the workload and just maintaining these plans, you know, and all the administration costs of, you know, billing monthly and saying this is included, this is not, and
the business aspect.
Congress does not get involved in pet insurance.
The Affordable Pet Act.
And the hard part with pet insurance right now is that I don't see how much they cover typically because they reimburse the client directly. So it's tough when people ask me, are these good health insurance plans for my dog? Because I don't see it. I hear about it.
Right.
Okay, so you've practiced up here and in Salt Lake as mm-hmm. well for a dozen years. And is there any one common universal dog or cat problem? Is it dental issues? Is it issues with paws? Is there any one thing that you see more than anything else?
It's definitely dental issues. That's been a huge eye-opener for me when I help dogs and cats and take out broken or painful teeth, how many phone calls I get weeks later saying, what'd you do to my pet? They're acting like a puppy again. And it's just because I removed a toothache, you know? And then the long-term studies are showing that with good dental care, pets are living longer, averages of 2 years longer. We never cleaned my dog's teeth growing up, you know? We never even thought about it. But now we're realizing it adds, you know, lifespan, time to their lives. And also that infection in their mouth gets into their bloodstream, affects their liver, their kidneys, their organ function, just like it does for humans, you know, how important dental care is for humans too. So dental care affects all breeds, all species that I see of species.
Yeah. And everybody comes home from the vet's office with, I don't know, beef flavored toothpaste and a long, dog toothbrush.
Uh-huh.
Do very many clients actually do that?
Yeah.
And how often should you do it do it?
It's hard to brush your dog's teeth.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to get my kids' teeth brushed and my dog's and by the end of the day. So, I think it's not done very much. I think a lot of people rely on chews, which clean the back teeth but don't really clean the front. No dog chews with their canine teeth or their front incisors. So brushing is a really important component, and I find it lengthens the time between dental cleanings. A lot of dogs still need the dental cleaning. It's just like you and I brushing between going to the dentist and having the tartar scraped off. One of the things I'm able to offer at my new practice is anesthetic-free dental cleanings, which is a new service up here that I actually met these hygienists working in Salt Lake and was intrigued, didn't really believe it at first. And then I watched them and actually checked their technique and monitored them, and they do an amazing job. And so they sit on the floor and they sit with the dog and they use kind of just meditative holds, and they're really calming with them, and they chew on like this rubbery kind of tennis ball thing, and they scale with an ultrasonic scaler while they're awake. So the only thing we can't do while they're asleep is, you know, deal with any fractured or broken teeth.
Sure.
Or take an x-ray, because if they bite the dental plate, they can cause a lot of damage. So
we've only got a couple minutes left. I'm curious, why did you decide on Park City? Are you a Park City resident?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I live up here. I've loved working up here, and I like being around to take care of my friends and neighbors' dogs, and being close to work so I can help, you know, dogs with emergencies, porcupine quills, or, you know, lacerations, and have a 1 minute commute.
Not bad.
Yeah, and I have young children in school up here too, so I wanted to be close to them.
Let me guess, they go to Jeremy Ranch?
They actually aren't old enough. They're only 18 months and three years old, so
okay.
They go to Deer Valley Academy,
nice.
The locals program over there. And my son's learning to ski. They take him skiing every week. So
my now 11-year-old learned to ski there when she was two. So
oh,
same
yeah.
Program.
They will go to Jeremy Ranch, though, once
Very
they're
fine.
Old enough.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for joining us. Kate Bjordahl has been our guest. Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, owner of the new Powder Paws Veterinary Clinic. Do you have a website?
I do. It's www.powderpawsvet.com.
And the address again?
It's 2780 Rasmussen Road, Unit B6, Park City.
Thanks for coming in, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
I love the name of your center, too, Powder Paws. It's perfect for this town.
It's all about the powder up here, right?
It is. Okay. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Thanks for
Take
coming
care.
In.
Very good, and we will be back to wrap up this edition of Mountain Money after this.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Well, Doug, we've covered the gamut of Park City life. Care for humans, care for our beloved pets, and a little skiing in between.
I'm detecting a healthcare theme, almost like there's a big event maybe happening tonight.
Well, we do want to remind everyone, if you have any questions, we have a panel of doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, Bill Barnes, who you heard from this morning, the federal relations representative for IHC. We have the chief counsel of the Intermountain Healthcare System. We have the Utah Health Policy Project's education director. We have food and beverage beginning at 5 at the Jim Santee Auditorium. So come and socialize with us, and then stay tuned for a live forum at 6:06 after NPR News at 6. We will broadcast the forum live. It will stream at kpcw.org as well. But please, if you can, come on down to the Santee, socialize, and then ask your questions directly.
Larry, we got a couple interesting news items. Ski Utah sent out a press release. Turns out most people plan their ski vacations more than the morning of, like we get to do here in Park City. And most people have already planned their ski vacation for the year. And there's a group that tracks how the season looks as far as bookings. They track 26,000 rooms in ski resorts. The company's Destinometrics is the one that does it. But the bottom line is, looks like business is about 20% ahead of last year. So if you look at the same bookings, pre-bookings ahead of time. So it looks like it's going to be a little more crowded out on the ski resorts this year, which is a great thing for the businesses here in town.
I was surprised how many people were here for Thanksgiving. The street was full. There were a lot of people.
I was gone.
Around.
It's usually empty, so I'm surprised to hear you say
that.
It
was pretty busy.
Yeah. And the other press release, kudos to High West. Jet Setter Magazine named them one of the world's best après ski scenes. As locals, we know that already. It's a great place to hang out. But kudos to Dave Perkins and the rest of the team there at High West. That's a nice recognition.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of bars, we promoted that last week. We were going to have John Taffer, who runs the show Bar Rescue on Spike TV, and you and I both watched several Bar Rescue episodes, and then with no time to spare, he canceled on us last Monday morning, and I didn't know why at the time, but then go back to my desk and find out that the night before, or two nights before, at one of the bars he had rescued, there was a murder in which the owner who he had rescued shot the leader of the band and killed him. So clearly, and a week before that, there'd been another
murder. He's
accused
of doing that.
Allegedly, let's get that in there. So clearly, John Taffer thought the conversation would go that way, although at the time I didn't know about it, so he would have skated on that one.
That's right. That's
but
right.
In any event, that's why he canceled, and we may try to get him back.
I hope we do.
Because it is an interesting show. You know, one other ski note, Deer Valley Resort opens this weekend with the Celebrity Ski Fest. And there's also a new award out, the World Ski Awards. And Deer Valley won Best United States Ski Resort in the first World Ski Awards.
There's a lot of good stuff happening in town.
Boy, you know, do we live in paradise or what? And the snow is just kind of barely starting to fly, so it's all good. I want to thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. This Green Earth is in this time slot tomorrow. Please join them. This is KPCW Park City.